My name is Oliver Percival, and my background is as an architect. That's my day job. And I've been doing that self-employed for about 20 years after working for a company. But during the course of my career, well, early on, I was introduced to the sort of the health aspect of buildings, which is usually neglected. But that involves the exposure to occupants to electromagnetic fields. And that's become much, much more relevant, of course, these days, as we're not just exposed to the electric field, but also the electromagnetic fields that are increasingly radiated by our devices.
I mean, it sounds to me almost like you might be the architect to go to if somebody wants to have some sort of Faraday cage to live in.
Yeah, there are different ways to approach it, aren't there? And there's obviously very different ends of the market now. There are the people who are extremely electrosensitive, and they do need dwellings to be designed that sort of mitigate and shield against the outside radiation.
Yeah, I suppose it's a bit naughty of me to make fun of it, because this is most definitely, you know, there are some people that do get very much affected by this, but they are both ignored by the industry and by government.
Yes, unfortunately. I suppose it's a sort of underclass which always exists at the beginning of an industrial hazard being recognised and sort of shouted about by the brave and effective minority. But, you know, sadly, the numbers are going to increase probably quite rapidly as everybody is exposed to chronic, well, acute levels of chronic exposure, especially in cities. But I would say actually the elephant in the room is everything inside people's houses. You know, we were looking at a mast in Berkshire today and at the weekend, where the levels in the street are, we'd say, 3 volts per meter, which is about halfway up a normal acousticon meter. But actually, you know, and that was a great concern to the residents. But I have to remind them that in their own houses, if they measure their Wi-Fi, their phones, all their devices, people are living in a soup of 3 volts per meter the whole time without realizing.
Okay, so I've been obviously following very closely the concerns about the mobile data network 5G going up, and you see these masts now, massive things. They actually look quite ugly and imposing, very, very much different to the previous generations.
Mm. Yes, they do. They are quite strikingly different, aren't they? They look quite advanced in Star Trek compared to the lollipops that were a bit more inconspicuous, to be honest. And these new ones are really quite pronounced. They're quite snazzy in some ways, but yeah, it is a different generation, and they are doing a slightly different thing, these new 5G masts. Just to describe them, I think it's important to clarify the terms, because there's a lot of sort of 5G word bandied around and people don't quite know what it means. I do that. That may be slightly deliberate on part of industry, just to make it all a bit confusing, and it's just business as usual. We've just added 4 to 5, but there is a step change. The first thing to stress, however, is that the 5G masts are still operating in the same frequency band, which is FR1, as the 4G, 3G, 2G. Now that means that they're all still sub 6 gigahertz in frequency. And in Britain at the moment, they tend to be around the 3.6 gigahertz range. So they're not the the much touted millimeter wave frequencies, which are 20 gigahertz and above. That isn't happening yet, but it's only in actually very, very specific situations or applications. You get mast to mast or point to point signaling, which is 26 gigahertz in Britain. But that's, you know, that's backhaul territory, not the street stuff. So it is all the similar frequency, but the difference is the beam forming. So these new 5G masts are certainly future-proofed, if not enabled already, to make directional beams. It's sometimes called phased array or MIMO, which is massive in, massive out, or multiple in, multiple out. So that's the clever way of focusing the signal to particular devices.
Okay, so I mean, we're used to seeing things like Jodrell Bank, aren't we? Or else the great big rotating radars at the big airfields, you know, the big airports and things. But what you seem to be saying to me is that this is a way of electronically focusing you know, a beam coming out from a 5G mast rather than using one of these kind of radomes.
Yeah, well, the original sort of 4G, 3G masts, again, they didn't need to rotate, but they did create an omnidirectional signal, which is a bit like you drop the pebble in the pond and you get the radiating ripples. So that was the omnidirectional old technology. It's still in use. But the, yeah, the new way is to steer the beams, but without moving the antenna, which is very clever. People should look it up, really, to see how phased array antennas work. But they just create some interference hotspots, which focus the beam in particular directions by slightly altering the angle. It's a very tiny angle. It's not like the whole dish would move. It's a very tiny angle between the array of 64 micro antennae. So it's incredible engineering. You know, hats off to boys with toys, really. But they usually charge ahead without considering the other implications of the new technology.
Well, yeah, and one of the things I've been flabbergasted about is the failure of the Green Party to really pick up on, you know, the fact that we're starting to send massive amounts of our data through the air using massive amount of energy, where the systems for sending it down fibre now mean that almost no energy is used if we have a, you know, a hard connection. So this seems to be almost like we've set off completely in the wrong direction with 5G.
Yeah, okay. You mentioned the environment. Absolutely. There are some massive red flags in this issue. Well, there are three really main red flags of this technology. One is the surveillance problem, which it empowers. But the other two, public health, we started talking about. The third one is the environment. The data that even the industry itself are working with right now absolutely crucify any council's attempt to follow a sustainable agenda if they're encouraging the proliferation of all these masts. And they use three times as much power as a 4G mast. That's just operational, which is about as much as 73 homes. Then you've got the usage from the entire network, which could reach up to 20% of total emissions by 2030, but in context it's about 2% at the moment, which is equivalent to the airline industry. But
there's been concerns in the Republic of Ireland that actually literally within a couple of years that these masts and the data that they're projected to use could swallow up the entire electrical supply of the country. And I've read figures around 2,000, 3,000 times more energy is used to send data through these systems than it would be through fiber. So I cannot understand how anybody can justify this in these environmental terms.
Yeah, well, the other part of the life cycle analysis or consumption or footprint of these masts is actually the amount of energy used by the server farms or the data centers. They account for about 40% of the energy use of the telecoms network. And that's quite staggering, isn't it? You can imagine it very easily. They're holding all this data, they're processing the data, they're flying it around the world. So half is that end, the back end, and the other half is the masts and the devices in use at the front end. And in between is the embodied energy of all the devices and the installation, you know, the mining, the throwing away, the recycling, the importing. It really adds up to staggering figures. And yes, the Green Party that's really quite silent about it. And I don't know why. You know, I can't really speculate. But at the moment,
it may be simply that the industry has, you know, got to them. But anyway, look, you started talking a bit about public health, because I think at the end of the day, we need to know, is this safe? We're being told, yes, it is safe. I noticed that the regulatory body, the EU regulatory body, is basically controlled by the industry itself and funded by the industry itself, which sounds to me actually a little bit corporatist, even fascist. You know, the idea that we're asking all these people who are making fantastic amounts of money out of all of our data communications, whether their product is safe or not. We need to have someone independent, and these people aren't. So anyway, what about public health?
Yes, well, it does boil down to the regulatory bodies. And unfortunately, as with every major industry, the government agencies are captured. That is a clear fact. It's the same with medicine. It's the same with, well, with every big industry. So it goes back to the ICNIRP, but the kind of the body which all the governments refer back to, and that stands for the International Council for Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection. But they're based in Germany, and they're non-governmental, they're an independent organization. Of course, there is a revolving door between them and the industry. Now, partly, to play devil's advocate, you could say, well, we need industry experienced people because they understand the topic, but not when they have vested interests and conflicting interests, which require them to preserve the dominance of this industry and this technology at all costs.
Well, I would say, actually, what you really need is people who have been injured by this sort of thing in the past. Yes. You need those people sitting around interrogating the facts rather than people who have built their careers on ever more data being flown around the world.
Yes. You certainly need a balance in the committee of doctors, independent scientists, yes, witnesses, victims. But yeah, it's industry experts at the moment. And it means that the guideline safety levels, the standards, are incredibly out of date. And they're irrelevant, frankly, because I don't know if people realize, but they're just based on what they call the thermal effect of radiation exposure. So that means it's just measuring the amount of radiation or setting a limit to the amount of radiation which will heat your body to a certain amount before they consider that it causes biological harm. Now, that amount, I mentioned 2.5 volts per meter earlier. The the guideline net safe level is 56 or 61, depending on the country, volts per meter. So that's 20 times what people are feeling in their bedrooms and in their streets.
Oh, now, is there anything, sort of a piece of kit that people can get hold of, listeners can go and get, that they can wave around either in their house or outside to determine, you know, just how much exposure they're getting to this? Because obviously this is the Trojan horse of all of this, is that this stuff is invisible. I will just say anecdotally that when I first switched my Wi-Fi on in my home, I switched it off again pretty sharpish because I thought I can feel this in the atmosphere. Now, not everyone is quite as sensitive as that. And also, of course, after a while, we get used to it. So is there any sort of, snazzy little device that we can get, you know, that will help us guide us through into this invisible world?
Yes, there is. Yeah, the one I've got, which I use, is called the Acousticom 2. That was developed by an English gentleman who runs PowerWatch. I've forgotten his name right now, but it will come back. Alistair Phillips. And he ran PowerWatch, the website, Acousticom 2, and it's available from EMF or EM Fields, who are based in Cornwall. So it's pretty.
Yeah, how much?
£165 at the moment, I think. There is a link on my website to radiation meters. It's on there.
Okay, you better tell us your website as well then.
Yes, so it's RF, which is Radio Foxtrot Info. So Radio Frequency Info, rfinfo.co.uk.
Okay, great. So once you get one of these, you start waving it around. What are you likely to find?
You'll find, so it's calibrated up to, in terms of frequency, up to 8 gigahertz. So that currently covers all the situations in Britain at the moment, or should do. And in terms of radiation intensity, it's measured in volts per meter, and it goes up to 6 volts a meter, which is a tenth of the apparently safe levels. But 6 comes up as red on this because it's designed and calibrated by people who understand the biological or non-thermal effects of this radiation.
I think that's probably where we need to go next is, yes, I think most of us can understand that actually heating your body temperature up a bit is likely to be only one of the effects that this kind of radiation has. So what evidence is there that people are being harmed other than just being warmed up a bit?
Yeah, there's a staggering amount of evidence, and there's been a staggering amount of evidence since the 50s, you know, when radar was being studied and used, and in the early days of just radio frequency radiation, which is actually a longer wavelength. than what we're seeing with mobile phones. I think what's really useful and interesting to understand is what the mechanism is, or what the feature of this radiation is that causes adaptive stress in the body that is not thermal. And so they call it biological harm or biological effects. And it arises simply from the fact that man-made radiation is what we call polarized. So it travels in at 90 degrees to itself in one format, whereas natural radiation is completely depolarized. So you can imagine it's like white noise, the natural radiation. But the other thing is that the man-made stuff is pulse modulated. So imagine some Chinese drip torture is ping, ping, dash, dash, lots of, you can hear it when you turn, well, the acoustimeter, you can hear it as noise, or like the old cassettes that used to load programs on computers. You've got that terrible screechy noise. That is the audible version of what your body is invisibly and subaudibly hearing or experiencing. And they know from research, even with DARPA in America, that this causes adaptive stress in our cells and in our biological structures. You can quite easily imagine that, can't you? It's just, it's sharp and it's aggressive, whereas natural radiation is soft and we're used to it. You know,
yeah,
we know,
but I mean, look, I'm looking for evidence of this causing harm and what sort of harm we've found that it causes in the body.
Yeah, okay. So in terms of evidence, the most well-known or publicized studies recently were the US United States National Toxicology Program, NTP, that they studied the effect of radiating rats for 10 years. They were funded to the tune of $30 million. They took 10 years to do it. They published their results a couple of years ago, and they found clear evidence of harm, of biological harm, at a non-thermal level over that time period. That, predictably, the industry, of course, rebutted that and said it was an invalid study, etc. But the US NTP is the gold standard of this type of study. It has never been challenged or rejected before when it's come up with a finding. So, yeah, it's suspicious that this should be the first time it didn't suit.
And, yeah, anyway, so what did it do to the rats?
For the details of that, I have to go back to the study. But I know that the conclusion was that there was clearly an effect, and it was the increased incidence of cancerous tumours. I'm not going to quote any more because I'd want to get it right, but it's there in the document. There are links on my website to these. There's also the Ramazzini Institute in Italy, which was funded 10 million euros by the EU, and they carried out research over 5 years, again on rats, exposing them to, interestingly, not just the sort of 56 volts per meter radiation, but right down to 5 volts per meter, which is very similar to what humans are experiencing day to day. And there they found clear evidence of cancer from the exposure. And again, for more information, I'd go and read the studies direct. But the most significant one, I think the most useful document for here in Britain, well, for everywhere, but it's a homespun thing, which is called the FHIRE Medical, P-H-I-R-E Medical Consensus Statement, which it's got 3,500 signatories of medical experts and scientific experts, and then many thousands of signatories from the public, that is declaring that these devices, masks as well, are causing biological harm. And, you know, it's asking for action from the authorities, from the governments, to recognise this biological harm. It's only 10 pages long. It's a very clear, concise statement, and it lists a lot of credible peer-reviewed studies that indicate the effects that are had. So that's a good one. But, you know, I can go on. There are thousands. There are many expert groups which have been producing studies. There's the Naval Medical Research Institute in America, the NMRI. They have recently declassified hundreds of studies that were carried out between the 50s and 70s. So it goes back a long way. The Russians have got thousands of studies. The Chinese have got loads. You know, it's really not a point of debate anymore. And even if people want to have a debate, the fact is that in a course of law, you know, a topic is analysed by the weight of evidence, which isn't physical weight. It's the equivalence of one side have got a decent amount of peer-reviewed studies. That's the kind of the baseline. Okay, they're peer-reviewed, so they are regarded as objective and sensible. And the other side have got a stash of peer-reviewed studies. The fact that you've got a balance on both sides means there is uncertainty by definition. It means there is a debate. And that should invite a precautionary approach when this is something which affects public health. But the governments worldwide are just looking to the ICNIRP, who say there is no evidence on the side of harm. But there's clearly fatuous and mendacious to claim such a thing.
Can you remind us of your website again, please?
Yeah, rfinfo.co.uk.
rfinfo.co.uk.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that people are becoming more and more reliant on this. Maybe people haven't upgraded to 5G. Can you see a way to sort of change this technology to alter policy direction so that the harmful effects of radiation are minimised?
Yeah, well, obviously fibre is the safest and most efficient way. But also, I can understand it costs more because they have to dig up roads and lay it to the houses. Wireless transmission of just your broadband service, of course, you know, that's the temptation, is the industry just make broadband wireless rather than wired. But it has to go the other way. It has to be wired. In terms of mobile phones, mobile devices, of course, they're here to stay. We need to be realistic. So what to do about that? It's a very tricky question. I think it's about the course of public opinion. I think it's obviously the 5G technology is not consumer led. We do not need it to satisfy the demands being made by people's mobile phones. So it's industry led. It's about machine to machine. It's about self-driving cars. It's about gathering huge amounts of data from the environment about people and things, which is not for us. That's for control. That's for surveillance, good or bad. So maybe the public needs to become aware enough to say enough is enough. We draw a line. We don't want our streets to be filled with the smart city systems of Wi-Fi that are these small cells everywhere.
Well, you know? I mean, I hate to say it, but that's exactly what's happening. I wonder, I mean, is there anything listeners can do to keep an eye open for where a mast might be being proposed near them, or to fight a planning application or whatever bureaucracy there is that these companies have to go through to put a mast up there?
Yes, at the moment, the government's trying to deregulate the telecoms industry so they can have carte blanche to put masts everywhere. They already have carte blanche to put small cells everywhere on lampposts. So that's the mesh networks in cities, the smart cities. But the big masts still mostly need at least prior approval, which is a form of planning permission where it is assessed on sighting and appearance. And we argue very strongly that that health is a function of sighting, and so is environmental pollution. So it's definitely worth keeping an eye on the council website, or I've got a register of mast applications on my website where people can find the reference number, and there's instructions on how to then make a comment or an objection. And that is quite successful. About 60 or 70% of masts are being refused at the moment. I wouldn't say that's on public health grounds necessarily, because most of the councils have been told by the government that there is no health risk and thou shalt not judge it on health. But we're trying to engage with as many councils as possible to encourage them to consider this as a material consideration, which they should be. But at least on appearance, a lot of councils are just saying no. So definitely worth doing that, and leafleting neighbours and just raising awareness, because you don't know where that will lead. It is planting seeds. And eventually, you know, if I had one right outside my house, I would not stop campaigning to the council about the hazard, the environmental effect, and all these non-thermal effects, which are just not recognised. They have a duty to protect public health and to take notice of current evidence, not just the opinion of the ICNIRP or one sole body, there are lots of other bodies worldwide which do recognise the biological harm. They're just not given the so-called authority to declare the safety levels. So we need to educate.
So, I mean, is there a sort of a regional... because obviously people need to get together with people in their own area to do this kind of thing effectively, Oliver.
Well, we do comment on masks nationwide. You don't have to live near in the borough, in the catchment. But obviously it's of much more impact to councillors if more local residents are making their wishes known and their concerns. But you can do it across the country. And there are local Facebook groups. There's a new one for just masks, listing mask application numbers. So people can across the UK access that. And actually go through the Freedom Networks, you know, talk to them and start getting together, join the Stand in the Park. People are increasingly talking about the 5G issues in the Stand in the Parks.
I suppose the other thing is that you do, you know, if one is going up right near your home, the council should be sending you the planning letter about it. Is that right?
Yes, they should notify you if you're within a certain distance. They often fail to, which does invalidate the application, but not many people pick up on that. But yeah, if you're very close, you should get a letter. But you need to look out for signs, look out on the planning, your local planning website. If you want to be really diligent, just keep an eye on the new applications every week that are coming up on your local council website.
It's a tremendous amount of useful advice there, Oliver, particularly in, you know, this whole idea of starting to become aware about something which it seems to me the industry and government too complicit with it. And the regulators really don't want us to be aware about. Your website, I'll just remind listeners again, RF, that's stands for radio frequency, rfinfo.co.uk.
Yeah, well, technocracy, I think it's just important. And in my talks where I'm increasingly joining Freedom Network or just local invitations to talk about this, and the recent theme I've had to introduce to just the what is radio frequency radiation, what is the harm, what are the steps to take to protect yourself and mitigate your exposure is please wake up, because this is about technocracy. The 5G network is a crucial pin or part of the puzzle to enable the mass surveillance and the management of all the data coming from so-called digital passes, should that ever be accepted by the population. So we need to become aware of all these different strands being brought together. I think the best person to educate yourself with on this is Patrick Wood, or Catherine Austin Fitz. You know, they're on the first page of the list that you have, Tony. It is fascinating and it's terrifying, and let's hope it doesn't come to pass. But people need to start thinking and just resisting by choosing analog ways to live: cash, walking, talking, telephones, hardwired broadband, and getting in touch with their councils, their councillors, and their neighbours, and just choosing a different life that's more analogue and more sustainable, frankly.
Yeah, it seems like we're trying to be driven into a digital world. We need to remind ourselves we're not digital, we're analogue. Oliver Percival, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks, Tony.